From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Conservatives from around the country came to the Conservative Political Action Conference last week, where they heard Romney drop out of the race, McCain get booed, and President Bush discuss the primary without mentioning the name of the presumptive nominee. David Kirkpatrick, who writes about politics and the conservative movement for the New York Times, was at the conference. We'll ask him for his impressions of the conference and the divisions within the Republican Party. It looks like TV and movie writers will be back at work on Wednesday. The leadership of the Writers Guild of America reached an agreement with producers over the weekend. Our TV critic David Bianculli will explain what this means for the writers and for us, the viewers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Senator John McCain is the presumptive presidential nominee of the Republican Party, yet over the weekend he lost the Louisiana primary and the Kansas caucuses to Mike Huckabee. McCain was booed by some people in the audience when he spoke Thursday at the annual Conservative Action Political Conference, known by the acronym CPAC. Mitt Romney chose CPAC as the place to announce his withdrawal from the primary race. CPAC is a conference which has been hosted by the American Conservative Union since 1974. It brings together thousands of conservative activists and leaders to set the agenda for the movement. My guest, David Kirkpatrick, was at the conference, which began Thursday and ended Saturday. He's a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He covered the conservative movement during the 2004 presidential race and still often writes about the movement. David Kirkpatrick, welcome back to Fresh Air. What was the main impression you took away from CPAC?
Well, the big event this year for me and everybody else was Senator John McCain. Senator McCain arrived at CPAC knowing he had some work to do to kind of shore up his support on the right. And the stakes for both sides were up significantly because early in the day at CPAC, Governor Mitt Romney bowed out of the race. All but saying that he was going to assign his delegates to or endorse Senator John McCain and throw his delegates behind Senator McCain. So Senator McCain arrived at CPAC, a kind of reviled figure on the right who very much needed the support of the conservative activists who'd gathered there. So the million-dollar question for me and everybody else was, you know, how was he going to do? Was he going to be able to convince them that he was with them, that he could speak their language, that he was on their side? Was he going to square off against them? How is that going to come out? And my takeaway was he still got a lot of work to do. I was frankly surprised by the negativity of the reception. When he spoke, people booed him several times. About half the crowd remained seated even during the biggest applause lines in his speech. Pretty much the folks who did stand up were students carrying McCain for President signs, meaning the students packed into the room by the McCain campaign.
What did he say that actually got the boos?
I think the things that got boos from the crowd were when he talked about his habit of reaching across the aisle and working with Democrats, or when he touched on things like the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reforms. Those are very unpopular with conservatives.
Yeah, why are conservatives and evangelicals, or at least many evangelicals, so opposed to McCain?
You know, it's an interesting question, and it gets at some of the complexity of the movement. The phrase that comes up again and again is people say, you know, as soon as I get ready to start liking Senator McCain, he sticks his finger in our eye. It's not any particular policy position he's taken. It's just that time and time again, he kind of bucks the movement, and he maybe even seems like he enjoys it a little bit. He likes to break ranks with his party. He likes to work with Democrats. He likes to do his own thing, and it makes people on the right feel like they can't trust him. I mean, the specific examples, the most recent one, of course, is his immigration bill with Senator Kennedy that would have allowed illegal immigrants to become citizens if they paid a fine and did some other things. McCain-Feingold, which was campaign finance reform. He voted against a federal marriage amendment banning same-sex marriage. He supported embryonic stem cell research. In 2000, when he was running for president, he gave a speech referring to certain evangelical leaders as agents of intolerance. He's voted against a big tax cut that President Bush was pushing. He voted for background checks for gun sales at gun shows. All of which, you know, those may seem like small things, and it's hard to know at the rank and file level, at the real grassroots, how much that means to people. I mean, it may be that your average conservative thinks John McCain, POW, he'll cut my taxes, I'm with him. But at the top of the movement, if you're really paying close attention, here's a guy who again and again and again sort of sticks it to you in ways that are uncomfortable for you.
Well, McCain has supported the war. He supported the surge, very behind President Bush on this. But you say that even his support of the war isn't going over well among conservatives. Why not?
Well, that's a kind of a complicated question again. I mean, when he stands up in front of CPAC and says, I support the surge, I'm going to win this war, the crowd goes wild. That's one of his best lines. But what's interesting is if you hang around the CPAC crowd for a while, you quickly learn that there is by no means unanimity of opinion on the subject of the initial invasion. A lot of conservatives, especially since the beginning of the war in Iraq and its aftermath, a lot of conservatives don't like the idea that the U.S. will be a kind of international policeman, that the U.S. will be exerting its weight in the world as a force for good instead of just trying to protect our own national interests and borders. And that goes back to the sort of early history of the modern conservative movement coming out of the 1950s and 60s. In the 80s, during the Cold War, there was a feeling that communism was a kind of existential threat to our way of life. And so even conservatives who had a skeptical view about America's role in the world could get behind the idea of facing down the Soviet threat wherever it occurred. But now that's beginning to recede, and so that sort of common call to arms against Soviet communism. And so now you see it reemerging on the right, a division between people who say, yeah, we should be using our military strength around the world to solve problems in places like the Middle East, to make the world a better place. And others who say, you know what, now we can go back to our traditional conservative skepticism about those uses of American power, which really are traditionally liberal. And the word they use for that kind of approach is Wilsonian. John McCain is very much a Wilsonian. He's somebody who thinks that America can and should be a force for good in the world, and that's why we have the strength that we do.
If, as you put it, communism was a glue that held together different groups within the Republican Party, is terrorism having a similar effect within the Republican Party now?
I would say it's too soon to tell. You definitely hear more talk on the left than the right about the idea of Islamic fascism, that there is this ideology, this sort of force in the world out there which, like communism, is an existential threat to our way of life, that wants to undo us. But this political landscape is very different from the Cold War in that throughout the Cold War, the left was in a different place. There was a live debate within the U.S., you know, going back to the 30s and 40s, there were some people who thought communism was, you know, not so bad. Later on, there were people who debated the idea of containment. There were real differences in opinion about the nature of the communist threat and about what the U.S. should be doing around the world to oppose communism. That's not at all the same anymore. After September 11th, there was widespread unanimity on both sides of the aisle that the U.S. needed to strike back, that this was a terrible thing. There's no one who will say, you know what, terrorism's got its merits in the way that there were people who said socialism, communism, not so bad. And so it doesn't quite have the partisan political glue effect that the Cold War once did.
So what is McCain trying to do to win over evangelicals and conservatives?
It was interesting to see his speech at CPAC. He tried to remind people a couple times that he is pro-life. He has a consistent voting record against abortion rights in every instance. This year, as opposed to 2000, he's been a notch more forthcoming, talking about his own faith, his own religious feelings. There's quite a bit of that, actually. If you read his memoir of his time as a POW, there are plenty of references to his faith and to prayer services and moving stories about that. But in 2000, he was very reticent about that, didn't want to talk about it on the campaign trail at all. Now he's doing that a little bit more. His campaign cut a commercial about one particularly moving experience he had on Christmas Day, venerating a cross in the sand with one of his Vietnamese captors. So he's done all that. But in his speech at CPAC, which was really the moment, I mean, this was it. Everybody had come waiting to see, you know, how's he going to do? Is he going to make peace with the right? That stuff felt kind of tacked on, honestly. His first part of the speech where he talked about wanting to cut taxes and the areas of common ground that he had with conservatives, he stumbled a couple times, and his heart didn't really seem like it was in it. He was trying, clearly. But it wasn't until he got to the end of his speech, when he talked about foreign policy concerns, the war in Iraq, that he really sort of found his voice, and he felt like he was speaking from the heart, and there was a lot of passion in it. And that squares very much with the perspective that a lot of people in the audience had going into this, which is Senator McCain is somebody who cares a lot about the war in Iraq. He cares a lot about international affairs. And he doesn't kind of have a burning passion for things like repealing the estate tax or lowering marginal income tax rates or, for that matter, banning same-sex marriage or abortion. So that's his stumbling block.
My guest is David Kirkpatrick, a Washington correspondent for The New York Times, who often writes about the conservative movement. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Kirkpatrick. He's a correspondent in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. In 2004, he covered the conservative movement during the presidential campaign, and he still continues to frequently write about the conservative movement. And we've been talking about the Republican primary campaign and the CPAC conference that happened over the weekend. That's the Conservative Political Action Conference. James Dobson, one of the leading evangelical leaders, says he won't endorse John McCain under any circumstances. He has endorsed Huckabee, and he only did that very recently. He seemed reluctant to endorse Huckabee until now. Huckabee has had trouble winning over the older evangelical leaders. So what does the Huckabee endorsement mean?
Well, if you are an anti-McCain dead-ender, if you are no how, no way can you go for McCain, Huckabee is the last game in town. Huckabee's not going to win. I don't think anyone pretends that he's going to win the Republican nomination for president, except perhaps Governor Huckabee and his campaign managers. But right now, Huckabee's success, every time he wins a state, and he won a few over the weekend, and frankly, I'll bet he wins a few more, every time he wins a state, that makes things harder for Senator McCain and his conservative critics. Senator McCain needs to make peace with conservatives so that they will be fired up and ready to support him in the general election. And the better Huckabee does, the harder that is for him, because the greater a sense they have that McCain is embattled, that he doesn't have a mandate, and that McCain needs their support. So when McCain came to CPAC and gave his speech, what one conservative activist said to me on the way out, this is like a sort of awkward teenager who's trying to ask you to the prom. You know, he wants to ask you, he just can't find the right words. So their takeaway from his speech was, he knows he needs us. Now we've got to see what we can get from this guy.
Yeah, well, what do they want to get? What concessions do they want from John McCain?
Well, there are a number of things that float around there. First and foremost, they'd like a vice presidential pick who is young and stoutly, vigorously conservative, because that's someone who 8 years from now, should McCain win, that's someone who 8 years from now would be in a position to become president.
Does that mean conservative and evangelical?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I mean, if you are a social conservative, if you're someone who's a conservative Christian, then you're going to want a like-minded vice presidential pick. If you're a fiscal conservative, you know, kind of like the anti-tax group, the Club for Growth, then that's less important to you, and you want somebody who's going to be truly committed to scaling back the size of government. It's easy to find someone who fits both categories if you want, but neither of those things is going to help McCain when it comes to winning over moderate or independent voters in the general election. And so that's the tricky thing for McCain. So the more Huckabee wins, the more the conservatives say, you've got to give us something. And to the extent that he does, that becomes harder and harder for him to carry into the general election. Some of the other things that come up that conservatives say they might like to see from him are, for example, stem cell research. He has said that he supports federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. Since that time, a lot of technology has developed that shows great promise with adult stem cells. So there's an easy out for him. He could come out and say, look, you know what? Technology has obviated this issue. There are some people who have moral qualms about embryonic stem cell research, and guess what? We don't have to do it anymore because there's another way. That would be a relatively painless thing that he could do that would say to conservatives, you know what? I'm giving you something here. I really need your support, and I understand your concerns. But that's not necessarily Senator McCain's style, and the reason why so many independents and moderates like him is because of his reputation for really unflinching independence. So he really is in kind of a tricky place.
Right, because if he makes concessions to conservatives and evangelicals, there goes the independence that he's admired for.
Yeah, to a certain extent. That's right, to a certain extent. Now, I'm sure that some of your listeners are thinking, well, come on. Running against a Democrat in the fall, everybody on the right is going to get behind him, and that might be true. And the other point is, okay, so these sort of hardcore activists who've really been paying close attention have a lot of grudges that they want to hold against Senator McCain. Your average man on the street who voted for Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, they don't really understand the details of this or that embryonic stem cell research bill, and they didn't care that much about the same-sex marriage amendment because it was never going to pass, and McCain's various crimes against the right in terms of compromises on judicial nominees, all that goes over their heads. So how much does this really mean? And I wondered about that myself. So I've been paying attention to what Rush Limbaugh's been saying over the last few days. He was one of the most vocal critics of Senator McCain from the right before CPAC, and I wanted to see how things have changed on the Limbaugh program and other talk radio programs since McCain's speech at CPAC and since he became really clearly the Republican nominee in waiting. And it hasn't changed that much. What Rush has been saying is, you know, McCain, Obama, Clinton, it's all the same. So we need to get out there and try to elect conservatives in Congress. That's something for the Republican Party. But for McCain, it's not great because, you know, there aren't that many districts where there are going to be really closely contested senator or congressional races, and they're not necessarily the districts where a Republican presidential candidate needs to compete. And so far the signs are that the voices of the right, the kind of spokesmen and cheerleaders for the conservative movement, are going to be – it's possible that they could be carping and criticizing the Republican nominee right up until November. So – Even if the grassroots doesn't in their own mind understand why conservatives don't like McCain or doesn't really care that much about that stuff, it's going to create a kind of – or it could potentially create a kind of ugly background noise for him that he needs to worry about all the way up until November.
It looks like there's no mathematical way that Huckabee could win the election, yet he's staying in the race. At CPAC, Mitt Romney officially withdrew from the race, saying, if I fight on in my campaign all the way to the convention, I would forestall the launch of a national campaign, and frankly, I would be making it more likely that Senator Clinton or Obama would win. Frankly, in this time of war, I simply cannot let my campaign be a part of aiding a surrender to terror. So he's basically saying he didn't want to fight McCain anymore and divide the party because that would make it less likely the party would win. So what do you think are Huckabee's motivations for staying in the race?
Well, Governor Huckabee says that the Democratic Party is hardly united at this point. There's still a live race going on for who's going to be the Democratic nominee. And so it's not that much of a setback to the Republicans that they're having a continued primary race. The other difference between Governor Huckabee and Governor Romney is Governor Romney was running an expensive campaign. He had a big infrastructure, a lot of advisors. It was costly for him to go on. And the victories he won by spending heavily and heavily out of his own pocket for advertising. Governor Huckabee is not that way at all. I mean, that means that for Governor Romney to continue, it was expensive and expensive to him personally. So in addition to the party loyalty reasons he mentioned, there's also a kind of a practical cost-benefit analysis for Governor Romney. For Governor Huckabee, that cuts in a very different way. He was running a very cheap campaign. He wasn't spending very much month to month. He didn't have much money for ads. He didn't have a big field team to go out and drum up crowds. He was basically relying on free media and his wits. And he's really won an astonishing number of states given his low resources. So I think it's certainly going to make him a stronger political figure going forward, that he continues to stay in at least for a while. I mean, I think the time will come when Senator McCain formally has the 1,191 delegates he needs, and then Governor Huckabee will probably bow out, and I'm sure at that point he'll bow out graciously. But until then, he's adding to his credibility and his stature in the future when it comes to future political races, or even a kind of internal conversation over what should be the agenda of the Republican Party.
David Kirkpatrick is a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Necessary Sins, a memoir by Lynn Darling about marriage, loss, and the many lessons of love. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from LendingTree.com, where you can choose from up to 4 customized loan offers, 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win. LendingTree.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It looks like our favorite TV shows will soon be back in production now that the leadership of the Writers Guild of America has reached an agreement with the studios. Our TV critic David Bianculli will tell us what the agreement means for writers and viewers. Also, more on divisions within the Republican Party with New York Times Washington correspondent David Kirkpatrick. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Kirkpatrick, a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He covered the conservative movement during the 2004 presidential race and still often writes about the movement. He attended the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, which was held last Thursday through Saturday in Washington. We're talking about divisions within the Republican Party over the presumptive nominee, John McCain. What's the Republican leadership thinking of McCain now, and what's their strategy? Ken Mellman, who managed President Bush's reelection campaign and then became the head of the Republican National Committee, he endorsed McCain Thursday evening. At the CPAC conference, President Bush said, "We will soon have a nominee who will carry the conservative banner into this election and beyond." But he didn't mention McCain by name. But over the weekend on Fox News, he called McCain a true conservative and said, I think that if John's the nominee, he's got some convincing to do to convince people that he is a solid conservative, and I'll be glad to help him if he's the nominee because he is a conservative. So is the Republican leadership starting to fall behind McCain?
Well, if you're a Republican partisan, that's a no-brainer. It's time to get behind McCain, full stop. I mean, he's going to be the nominee. If you want to win in 2008, then you want McCain to win. And so to the extent that you are associated with the Republican Party, that's where you're going. The thing about the conservative movement, and one of the reasons why I think it's had the vitality that it's had over the last few decades, is it kind of stands apart from the party itself. The conservative movement within the Republican Party still remembers the days when it was on the outside taking shots at what it considered to be establishment Republicans in the line of sort of Rockefeller, Ford, Nixon. A lot of them still see themselves engaged in a battle first and foremost for the soul of the party. And so they resist thinking only in terms of party loyalty and consider it a victory in some sense if they can be sure the Republican Party stays true to their principles, even if it goes down in the general election. And I think that's one of the things which distinguishes the left from the right at the moment. I don't know if that might be changing or not.
Ann Coulter, who is a professional provocateur, said that she'd rather vote for Hillary Clinton than vote for McCain. Are you hearing a lot of she's always very far out, but are you hearing other sentiments like that, basically saying, sit this one out?
No, that's bananas. I mean, she is really just trying to get attention with that comment. And she got a lot of attention, much of it negative, from the folks at CPAC, because certainly there is no love for Senator Clinton among rank-and-file conservatives. I don't think there's anybody encouraging people to stay home. I know Dr. James Dobson of Focus on the Family has said that out of conscience, he could not vote for McCain. But he's never gone so far as to say, you all out there ought to stay home too. I mean, that it's a blow to McCain that he's saying that and that he's indicating he's not going to get involved and encourage people to turn out, which he did to great effect in 2004 for President Bush. And it's a blow to McCain that Rush Limbaugh is saying things like Hillary, Obama, or McCain, it makes no difference. But come November, I think we'll hear Rush being quite critical of whoever the Democratic nominee is. There are things short of supporting McCain that conservatives can still do to make clear that they think the Democrat is a bad bet. So we'll probably see some of that.
Meanwhile, when you were at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, what were you hearing about Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama?
This conference was still preoccupied by the Republican race. One of the fun things about CPAC is you go in, they have an extensive gallery of souvenirs, exhibitors selling various tchotchka, which is usually very vicious towards prominent Democrats of the day. You know, Senator Kennedy, if there's no one else running for national office, but if there is a Democratic presidential candidate, Senator Kerry or Senator Clinton or Senator Obama. So there was some of that. But there was even some T-shirts criticizing Senator McCain. So the gang wasn't really focused yet on just going after the Democrat. And it's also harder now because we don't yet know which Democrat to criticize.
What did the anti-McCain T-shirt say?
Well, there was one T-shirt that stuck in my mind because I believe it said, I'd rather be waterboarded than vote for Senator McCain.
Yikes.
Yeah.
So what's the buzz about President Bush among conservatives now?
Well, President Bush spoke, I believe it was at 7:15 Friday morning, and he packed the House, and they loved him. President Bush is still very popular with the conservative base. Certainly nobody was critical of President Bush at this CPAC. In fact, they were less critical of President Bush at this CPAC than they have been in previous CPACs, in part because he's growing less and less relevant, I think, as his term comes to a close.
If McCain is so unpopular among many evangelicals and fiscal conservatives, how did he end up being the presumptive nominee?
Luck is certainly a factor there. he benefited from the fact that Huckabee and Romney were dividing the conservative vote, and neither Huckabee nor Romney is precisely perfect. Romney troubles a lot of people because of his past as a more liberal politician in the state of Massachusetts. Some evangelicals and others are troubled by his membership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He's a Mormon. Huckabee, on the other hand, leaves a lot of fiscal conservatives or hawks cold. So neither one of them was able to sort of unite the right. But together, they got more votes than Senator McCain has. Senator McCain has gotten a plurality of Republican primary votes, and he's won in a few of the states that award their delegates on a winner-take-all basis, which gives him a big lead. Those happen to be the more moderate states. But he has not won a majority of Republican primary goers. So some of it is luck. There's also a kind of a star factor with McCain. You can't get too far without remembering the fact that he was a POW, tortured in Vietnam for 5 years, and refused early release in order to keep solidarity with his fellow prisoners and his country. And I think that's impressive to a lot of conservatives. That's just impressive to a lot of people.
Well, David Kirkpatrick, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's always a pleasure.
David Kirkpatrick is a Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Now that the writer's strike appears to be settled, what does the new contract mean for writers and for the future of television? Coming up, we'll talk with our TV critic, David Bianculli. This is Fresh Air. There's good news for all of us who are tired of reruns and want to see a real Oscar ceremony. It looks like movie and TV writers will be back at work Wednesday after a strike which began November 5th. The Writers Guild of America Negotiating Committee unanimously and unconditionally recommended the terms of the new proposed contract. The ratification vote will take place over the next few weeks, but tomorrow, writers will vote on whether to end the strike during the ratification process, and they're expected to vote yes, end it. Our TV critic David Bianculli has been covering the strike for his website, tvworthwatching.com. David, I know you've been following the strike really closely. What's the most important gains the writers seem to have won based on this tentative agreement?
They were focused most on getting some sort of share of revenue out of the internet. They had gotten almost nothing when VHS came around, and they hadn't anticipated the strength of the home video boom, so they didn't want to get caught by the internet as it grew. So that was what the major sticking point of this whole negotiation was. They wanted a piece of that pie.
So what kind of piece did they get?
They get, in the third year of a three-year contract, they get 2% of whatever the profits are at that point. How they're defined, you know, gross, net, how they're checked, I don't think anybody's clear on at this point. They're treating it as a huge victory. With the VHS stuff, they got 4 cents on the dollar. With this, they're getting 2%. I'm not so sure it's a huge victory. I'm just glad everybody's back.
Now, I know, like, when I watch a TV show or even, like, a clip from The Daily Show on the internet, there's a commercial that you can't fast-forward past, that you have to watch first. I'm assuming that the producers are getting money for that commercial. Is that an example of the kind of revenue that the writers want a take of?
Well, there's two types. First of all, if you're watching that with a commercial attached, you're watching it on the official Comedy Central site.
Right.
Lots of people are just taking what they have recorded and throwing it up on YouTube, where there's no commercials, there's no revenue. And so you have the user-based YouTube model, which is, I got it, it's free, I just want to share it with you for free. And that's a really weird thing because somebody's got to pay for it originally for it to exist. On the official sites, yes, you will have advertising or some sort of streaming, and that's the sort of revenue that they know it, that exists, the writers do, and of which they want a piece.
Now, why were the producers so reluctant to give the writers a percentage of the profits? Because if the producers say, well, there's no money to be made on the internet, then the writers would be getting a percentage of zero, which means the producers wouldn't have to give anything up.
When we're talking producers here, and this is the term that they're all using, we're actually talking giant studio heads. We're talking the Daddy Warbuckses. Is that the plural of Daddy Warbucks of Hollywood? And so they don't want to give anybody anything. You know, just because they have this giant, giant pie, it doesn't necessarily mean they want to allocate a fair share. So they see the internet. Nobody knows what's going to happen with the internet in the next 5 years, but everybody knows something's going to happen, and everybody suspects it's a gold mine. So it's like the California gold rush. You don't know which claim is going to pan out. And this is not a big sharing time.
Was there a lot of infighting within the Writers Guild about what to demand, what to give in on, and what direction to head in, and how long to hold out? I mean, it was very hard on a lot of the writers and on everybody else who was out of work because the writers were on strike.
Right. The Writers Guild, the interesting thing about them is that only 10% of the writers in the Writers Guild are actively writing television. 90% either don't have work, can't find work, or have retired. And the older writers that aren't working now, their major concern is how they'll be paid for residuals, especially in new media. Because that's going to be a new money stream when the old money stream is drying up. Then you have the young writers who, the ones who are showrunners now or on writers' staffs now, they really are losing work and losing creativity, and their shows may be canceled because they're not going to come back. So there's two different groups at risk playing for two different things. But in a sense, they're all the prize that they all had their eyes on is new media. So they were in agreement for once.
And the residuals, it's like when your program is rerun, you get a residual. You get a payment on that rerun.
Right. And it took a long time for that contract to be written in a fair sense, just in terms of syndication for broadcast network television. Mm-hmm. Then there was cable. And now, you know, we're jumping to the internet, which is a complete unknown territory.
So writers want something similar to the residuals they've traditionally gotten for reruns. They want that to apply to old and new shows on the internet.
Yes. And as a writer, as a journalist, I sort of get that argument.
Now, what's some of the fallout of the strike in terms of how it's affected not only TV, but the larger entertainment industry?
The biggest thing is that the reason why it's settled now, there was like this perfect storm. Really, if it wasn't settled, or I'm talking in the past tense, and, you know, the real vote is coming up tomorrow. But everybody that I'm talking to and everything that I'm reading says that it's going to be over. And the reason is, by ending this week, you can still salvage the Oscars. You can still salvage a sense of pilot season. You can still have upfronts, which are when the networks present the pilots they've chosen to advertisers, at least in some semblance, you can have upfronts. Fox has already said they will have upfronts. And then you can have a May sweeps, which is important for smaller stations and for the networks to get momentum into the fall and the fall season. You don't have that now, everything falls apart and changes.
Are we going to have a regular new fall season?
That's my hope. It won't be quite so regular. It'll be this year, things are going to be slimmed down a little bit for the May sweeps and even for the fall season. But the question is what happens after that. If the model that they use this year just to keep going, if they say, we don't have to make 100 pilots anymore to choose which 6 or 8 we're going to put on as a network. You know, I mean, you know, as an industry, they can say we can do it with less. And if you do it with less once, then maybe you do it next year.
Talk a little bit more about that, about how the networks were forced to change during the strike and what changes that might lead to long term.
Right. Well, they couldn't order as many scripts or won't be able to order as many scripts. And so that self-selects the number of pilots you make. And they're talking about even going to series without pilots or just doing slimmer presentations. But if you have a choice of 100 shows or 100 scripts to get your lineup, the chances are greater that you're going to take some risks that might pay off big. This year, Pushing Daisies, my favorite new show of the fall, I don't think, have gotten through the process when there were only, 20% or 30% as many pilots or scripts approved. So I worry about the long-time creativity if they truncate the pilot process.
It seems like one of the casualties of the strike was 24. My understanding is that they just kind of decided to forget it for the whole season, even though some of the episodes were shot.
Yeah, they'd shot 8, but the idea was the big appeal of 24 and the big success of 24 is that it runs nonstop. Once they figured that that was the model, they didn't want to mess with that. So they figured they'll just hold 24 off. They'll film the rest of them as soon as the writer's strike ends so that the actors don't get released from their contracts. But now 24 won't show up until 2009 when American Idol comes around for its next January play. It also allowed Kiefer Sutherland to serve his jail time. so that was just – which he did during the writer's strike. That's just a nice bit of timing.
Now, the Screen Actors Guild contract is up for renewal in a few months.
Yes.
Is there likely to be a Screen Actors strike?
No. Actually, the actors have, in effect, gone on strike along with the writers. If it wasn't for the actors being as strong as they were in support of the writers wouldn't have gotten this agreement. The Oscars would not have been so threatened if it wouldn't have been written as an award show. It's the actors not showing up. So the actors getting what they wanted for the writers will have a favored nations clause. So they're going to – I really do not think that the actors will be striking in June.
So tell me some more about how the writers' contract is going to be good for the actors.
Because the actors sided with the writers and honored their picket lines, which meant that like the Golden Globes – almost, it didn't exist. No actors would show up. So the writers got to show some clout by saying, look, we can stop the Golden Globes. Now, the Golden Globes is not the Oscars. And the producer side, NBC, which had the rights to telecast the Golden Globes, made a mistake, I think, by saying, well, we'll go ahead and we'll just put on our telecast anyway and just have essentially a glorified press conference where we just give the announcement of the winners. Well, it was horrible. Everybody made fun of it. And so nobody wants that with the Oscars. So by fighting and sticking with the writers, the actors are getting, the writers will get a better contract. Therefore, the actors get that same contract.
So the actors will get the same kind of residuals that the writers have won?
Yes. Yeah, the actors are in the best position of all by coming last and by being the most visible.
My guest is our TV critic, David Bianculli. We'll talk more about the end of the writer's strike and what it means after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is our TV critic, David Bianculli, and we're talking about what looks like to be the end of the writer's strike. Since writers get residuals for reruns have been very helpful to writers. In the internet era, where a lot of TV shows are already being shown, and probably more will be shown on TV, is that likely to affect reruns and therefore the residuals writers get for reruns? Is that part of their concern?
Yeah, it affects it in two ways. In the one way, there are fewer places on local television, on broadcast television, for reruns to appear. You know, it's not the same as a generation ago when we came home from school in the afternoons and all those programs were all right there. Now it's, you know, you see People's Court and that kind of reality stuff in the afternoons instead. So there are fewer places to get that revenue stream. So the question is, will it be replaced by the internet? And a lot of internet sources haven't made the deal or show stuff for free. So they are worried about it, and that's what they're focused on. The solution isn't clear. Yes, reruns are going away on broadcast television, but broadcast television is going away. The world is changing.
One of the things the writers wanted but did not get in the new contract is jurisdiction over reality shows and animation. So mm-hmm. In other words, the people who write for the reality shows and the animated shows aren't covered by this contract. And I guess I don't understand why they're not considered writers, why they're not represented by the guild.
Yeah, it's a weird caste system. With the reality shows, this is a form that didn't really exist before 1999 in any formal way. So when the first ones came up, it was like, well, there's not really writing that goes in there. You don't have to be a guild. And then when it ballooned so quickly, there was initially some resentment, you know, among different camps of writers about whether they should be admitted. And with the animators, that I haven't understood for a long time. I don't understand why the scripts for The Simpsons can't compete as best comedy in the Emmys against shows like The Office. But they don't. They have to have their little separate category. Eventually, that may be corrected, but I think everybody understood early on that this wasn't the major issue at this time.
You know, I think that the writer's strike is such an interesting counterbalance to the whole idea of, you know, information should be free. Mm-hmm. The internet should be free. And now we're seeing, like, labor basically saying, but wait a minute, people need to be paid for their work. And if information is free on the internet, what happens to the writers? What happens to the musicians whose work is just being given away on it?
It's like authors. I remember, you know, Charles Dickens and Mark Twain used to have these sorts of problems when books that they wrote for their countries were taken by other countries and just reprinted and just said, well, for our audience, it's completely different. He said, no, they wouldn't exist if I didn't write them, so I deserve a cut no matter where you sell it. And we're not talking about books anymore, but it's the same idea. If these writers created these shows, they should get paid for them whenever someone sees them, wherever someone sees them.
David, one of the things you do on your website, tvworthwatching.com, is have picks every day for the best stuff to watch on television, old and new.
Yes.
So what should we watch tonight?
If it wasn't for Turner Classic Movies, it would be much harder to write about TV worth watching. It has been during the strike. And I think it was last Saturday where all six of the picks were old movies. There was no currently generated television that was worth it. Either the new shows like Kashmir Mafia or Lipstick Jungle or Lipstick Mafia, I've gotten them confused, aren't worth watching as new shows, or there are all these reality shows like My Dad Can Beat Up Your Dad if he's taking a lie detector test. I mean, I want regular television back. It may never come back in the form I want it, but I'm tired of this.
So what should I watch tonight?
Well, my favorite of my favorites tonight, there's two of them. There's It Happened One Night, which is that great old Frank Capra movie with Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. That's good on any night, especially on a slow TV night. And then
on Turner Classic Movies?
Yes. And then on country music television, there's tonight's edition of Crossroads is a concert with Alison Krauss and Robert Plant. And that's a really interesting pairing.
Great. Well, David, thanks for stopping by. Really good to talk with you.
All right, you too. Thanks for having me on.
David Bianculli is Fresh Air's TV critic and writes about television for tvworthwatching.com. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music by Dengue Fever, a band inspired by Cambodian pop music of the 60s and 70s. The Cambodian pop music was inspired by American pop that was broadcast during the Vietnam War on Armed Forces Radio. Dengue Fever was founded by brothers Zach and Ethan Holtzman. I just recorded an interview with them, which we'll hear sometime soon. The lead singer of Dengue Fever, Cham Namal, comes from a famous family of Cambodian singers. She now lives in L.A. This song is from Dengue Fever's new CD, Venus on Earth.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we compare the health care plans proposed by each of the presidential primary candidates. We'll talk with Jonathan Oberlander, an expert on health care policy who teaches at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.